Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about the state of relations between the United States and Latin America. And our guest will be Riordan Rowett. He's professor in the Paul Nitzer School of Advanced International Studies at the Johns Hopkins University in Washington, D.C., where he is also director of Western Hemisphere Studies and also director of the Latin American Studies Program. He has been following politics in Latin America for a long time. He's the founding director of the Center of Brazilian Studies there at Johns Hopkins, and also founding director of the program on U.S.-Mexico relations. As we talk in this first hour of Focus 580, questions, comments, of course, are welcome from callers. They always are. The only thing that we ask, however, of callers is that people just try to be brief. And we ask that so that we can keep things moving along, get in as many different people as possible. But anyone who is listening this morning is welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That is for local listeners here where we are. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is 800-222-9455. So if you're here in the community, Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. But anywhere around Illinois and Indiana, the signal will travel, or anyone listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Professor Rowett, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Sure thing.
I think that when you take a look at just recently what has been written about the president's last visit to Latin America to meet with the leaders of Latin America, you see two kinds of things. One, that if you look at public opinion surveys of people in Latin America, you find that the United States gets pretty low marks as far as the government is concerned and the president, and that people feel historically that the United States has been meddlesome in Latin America. On the other hand, there is this suggestion that, in fact, that as far as Latin America is concerned, that the Bush administration has been rather disengaged, which is surprising given the fact that when he ran for the presidency, he talked about the fact that he felt he had a very good understanding of Latin America, and that would be a plus if he was elected president. Let's try to talk about those two things, and first talk a little bit about how people in Latin America feel these days about the United States. Has anything changed recently?
Not really. The visit of the president to Mar del Plata, Argentina, a short while ago for a summit of the Americas, that is a meeting of all the presidents of Latin America, I think indicated the difficulty the U.S. is facing in Latin America. There really were two summits. One was the formal official summit with lots of photos and fancy lunches and dinners. And the other was an anti-summit held outside in the streets of the coastal city Mar del Plata, in which you had large pictures of Che Guevara, the Cuban revolutionary leader, anti-Bush slogans, and the Argentine Nobel Peace Prize winner condemning the United States for imperialism and for not being involved in South America. So we have two things going here. One is at the formal level, everyone's quite polite to the United States. At the informal level, I think there's increasing hostility and increasing disbelief in any future role of the U.S. in the region.
Well, what about the suggestion that the Bush administration has actually been rather disengaged and that Latin America has been, and perhaps this is understandable, that Latin America has been rather far down the agenda for the administration?
Very much so. It is not just this administration, but if you look back a number of years, there is rarely, if ever, anyone at the very top rung of the administration, Democratic or Republican, with any practical experience in Latin America. Unlike, say, in the Soviet Union or Russia or in Eastern Europe, Western Europe, even Asia. So that makes it very difficult for lower-level bureaucrats and policymakers at the Pentagon or in the State Department to get the attention of the people up at top. Second, our attitude towards Latin America in the United States has always been one that was based upon trade and investment. The U.S. is never quite viewed as getting involved in resolving social problems or dealing with some of the broader societal issues that really vex Latin America and that put it behind the Asian countries. So on both, I think that we're found wanting by most of our neighbors in the region.
Well, given the fact that people have been arguing for a long time that that Latin America is important for the United States, that is, there are real security concerns for the United States, and also that the United States should take an interest in the economies of the countries of Latin America. That is, when they are doing better, everyone is doing better, and there is now this great interest in trying to do what can be done to make a trade zone of the Americas, something like what has happened in Europe. And given all that, should we be surprised that not only this administration but other administrations seem not to be all that interested in Latin America?
Yeah, I think our history, unfortunately, is a series of momentary initiatives, such as 1994, when President Bill Clinton in Miami announced the beginnings of the negotiations on the free trade area of the Americas. Or when President Bush, the current President Bush, visited President Fox of Mexico and began to offer a much stronger partnership. That took place right before September 11, of course. But then we seemed to pull back. I mean, the man with the best record in terms of U.S.-Latin American relations was the first President Bush, who had, in his first 2 years, an absolutely stellar record of relations with Latin America. But that was put off track by his Middle Eastern war and then by his defeat by Bill Clinton for the presidency. So that's really the last time that we've had really strong engagement on a broad range of questions between Washington and the capitals of Latin America.
Well, obviously, we should be careful about talking about Latin America in monolithic terms, because there are different countries, there are different politics, there's different leadership. But having said that, if you ask a question like, well, what does Latin America want from the United States? What would they like to see the government of the United States do? Is there a kind of a short list?
Well, first and foremost, I think in the trade talks that there's a real concern on the part of Brazil and its partners in the common market of the South, Argentina, Paraguay, Uruguay, with opening up the American market to Latin American agricultural exports. That's the same problem the South Americans have with the European Union, of course, agricultural subsidies. There are certain things that the U.S. and Europe want the Latin Americans to do on issues like intellectual property rights, protecting patents, and there doesn't seem to be much of a dialogue right now, either in the Americas in terms of furthering the free trade area of the Americas, and that's what President Bush basically pushed during his visit to Argentina, and at the global level of attempting to bring to some positive conclusion the World Trade Organization trade talks that are about to open in Hong Kong. So we seem to have an impasse between the Latin American countries and their allies in the developing world and the European Union and the United States on a whole range of trade questions. Second would be immigration. Now, that's very specific to Mexico, but it's a very important issue in Mexico, you know, providing some legal status for the many Mexican workers who are in this country, legally and illegally. But they, of course, are very important in terms of the U.S. workforce. We're learning, for example, that billions of dollars flow back into South America, Latin America, in terms of remittances. That is, part of the salary of many of these workers goes home to support their families, open businesses, buy houses, which is a very important part of maintaining stability. So I think people in Latin America listen to some members of Congress who want to ban immigration or penalize immigrants and don't really understand why there isn't some understanding of the contributions of these folks in the American economy and in American society.
Well, given that here, again, we have two issues that here there are people in the United States that have definitely strong feelings about them. Immigration, there are people who feel that the controls should be tighter. There are some people who think that if it could be done, that we should build a wall between the United States and Mexico. And on the other hand, there are Americans here, particularly, I think, in the agricultural sector, who are interested in protecting their production from exports, from imports from particularly from Latin America. Here, that it seems that we have some fairly vocal constituencies who are opposing these particular policies, these things that that not only countries of Latin America would like, but it seems that the administration has spoken for. At least they've spoken for the free trade zone of the Americas, and also the president now for some time has been talking about putting something into place that would be I guess, in effect, a kind of a guest worker policy for the United States that would allow people to come legally to work to the United States for a period of years. It would not be a track toward citizenship. They would be required after a time to go back. But that seems to be his answer to that particular problem.
Yeah, it's a half answer to a much larger problem. And obviously, there are politics involved in all of these questions. But that, of course, is why we have presidents to provide strong political leadership and to explain to the American people why members of Congress are wrong to try to ban Mexicans from the American economy, because we don't have the people in America who do the jobs that the Mexicans and the Salvadorians and the Hondurans and the Ecuadorians are doing, first. Second, there's no question that agricultural subsidies is a domestic political issue. And that needs to be confronted by the president and by the Congress as well. Congress recently passed, just by two votes, and those votes had to be bought, a Central American free trade agreement that really isn't of great importance to the United States, since our trade with those countries is very small. But these issues, again, were fought out on the floor of the Congress and came very close to defeating the free trade agreement with the Central American countries. There are other agreements underway now with some of the Andean countries, with Panama. And I think they're all going to run up against the same political issues unless the White House is able and willing to take a very strong stand and explain why free trade is good for all of us on the trade side and why immigration is good for the United States as well as being good for these countries.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Riordan Rowett. He's professor of political science at the Johns Hopkins University in Washington, D.C. He's at the Paul Nitze School of Advanced International Studies, where he is also director of the Western Hemisphere Studies and also director of the Latin American Studies Program, and has been following politics in Latin America for a long time. Questions are welcome. We have someone here lined up and ready to go in Chicago, and others would be welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Here is our Chicago caller, line number four. Hello.
Hello. I'm sorry. I cannot let that lie continue that we do not have the people here to take these jobs. What we don't have in the United States is people who can accept the wages that they are giving to illegal aliens, which is why that there's a certain element that continues to want illegal immigration to go on. And you certainly must be aware of the fact that for centuries, African Americans, Asians, Puerto Ricans, legal Mexican immigrants have filled the jobs of waiters, farm workers, nannies, garbage people. These are not some sort of special jobs that just popped up. We do have the people here. We simply do not have people that can afford to accept those wages, which are below minimum wage, which at presently is way below a living wage. The second thing that I expect that you will be discussing at some point, since you're a Latin American scholar, is the fact that illegal immigration has on the countries that send the immigrants. Basically, illegal immigration, the opportunity to come to the United States, prevents Mexico from dealing with the injustices, the social inequities that it has to deal with. Sooner or later, it has to deal with them, or else we're going to have a civil war on our border. So, I mean, I think it's really important that we stop these very easy but inaccurate statements that don't help anyone.
Well, Professor Rowett, you want to respond?
Sure, why not? I think it's very well documented that there are not people out there that will take many of the jobs that the Latin Americans are willing to accept. Aren't many Americans who are willing to live under bridges in some cases and then get up and go to work the next day? There's no question.
No one should have to do that. I mean, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Sure, all right, right.
But don't you understand? No one should be having those working conditions.
I agree with that.
Why do we say this is a reason to bring in more illegal aliens so that they can have subhuman conditions?
Well,
I mean, I don't understand that argument.
From their point of view, these are not subhuman conditions compared to having no job whatsoever in their own home. country, being able to work here and to send money back home is extraordinarily important. Don't you understand that? That all the remittances going back home are extremely important.
I know many Mexican Americans who live in that condition, and they resent it. Yes, it's better than what's at home, but it's not that they think this is so great, and I'm glad and thank you, sir. They resent it because anyone realizes that that's subhuman. So to me, these are simply invalid arguments. Bring in illegal aliens because they're willing to work for less than minimum wage. They're willing to put up with subhuman conditions only because they don't have legal recourse.
That's why we
will keep them illegal. Or if we make them as guest workers, they'll be under the fear that we'll send them back at any time. This is simply exploitation. It's very offensive to me. And I think it should be offensive to anyone who's trying to wave a flag. If we believe in what this country was founded on, even though we understand at the time it was founded, it had limited application, if we believe that we have to extend that application, then we should not be bringing in a group of people simply to exploit them.
We're not bringing them in. Not bringing them in. You don't understand. They cross the border illegally. There is millions of dollars being spent every day trying to stop the illegal immigration into this country.
And we spend millions of dollars supporting them through having to hire schools, teachers who can speak both languages, having to have bilingual facilitators. So, yes, there's more money being spent trying to keep them here than there's being spent trying to keep them out. But the problem is we're not looking at the underlying causes. One, the reason why they have to flee, which is inequities in their country, and the reason why they're coming here, because we have a labor system that needs desperate reform. We need living wages for all people. We need to demand that all workers have decent conditions. I mean, to me, it's really horrible that you can say, oh, they're willing to live under bridges as if that's okay. No, the problem is that there's any worker in America living under a bridge.
I agree with you entirely. You change the political system then, ma'am. I can't do that where I'm sitting. You may be able to do it where you're sitting.
Well, I hope as citizens we can all do it with our vote, but also I don't think we change it by continuing to sprout the same tired, misleading ideas. I don't think that helps anyone.
Yeah, well, I guess I find your argument sort of tired and misleading as well, but that's what America is all about, to be able to disagree. If you can get the American Congress to move and increase the living wage for all workers in America, all of us have to applaud that, obviously. The American Congress isn't going to do that anytime soon. Second, the American Congress couldn't care less about the conditions in Latin America, and we, of course, can't intervene in the Latin American countries and make Latin American leaders do what they should do and we would like them to do. That's another very difficult issue for us to face as well.
That one thing that we have to see is that it really starts with each person and their attitude, and I don't think we have to continue on with this great man idea of either politics or history. We're not waiting for Congress. We put those people there, and they do respond, if only to save their very lucrative payroll. So I think that I'm sorry that you have the attitude that there's nothing we can do and we just continue on with this great man idea. I really think that every individual can do something. I think the first thing you have to do is really have clear thinking.
I think lots of people do things.
To try to pretend that all these workers are coming in because these jobs won't be filled by Americans. That's not true. We need to look at the underlying effect, the fact that these jobs are degrading, these jobs are very low paying.
No, not all the jobs are degrading. Many of the jobs, quite frankly, are very, very good. And many of the Latin Americans, and I know this for a fact, are delighted to have the jobs because they do have benefits, they do have medical care, and they do have money to send back home. You have to understand the realities of the region, ma'am.
I'm going to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me. I have some other people here now lining up, and the lines have lit up. I hope we're not going to get hung up on this point. Let me just ask you, Professor Rhoda, it sounds as if what you're saying is that you think whether the kind of thing that the president has talked about gets put into place or not, that people will continue to come here, and that you, as far as you're concerned, it would be better for them, it would be better for us if we made it possible for them to be here legally?
Now, to be here legally, I mean, we have many legal immigrants, of course, in this country who are very productive citizens. They vote in larger numbers than many other Americans do. They pay taxes, and, of course, they go to the school board meetings. Our issue is the constant flow of illegal immigrants into the country, and I think there's a real misunderstanding that these people are not necessarily criminals. Well, there are criminal elements in every part of society, that they're looking for work. They're looking to help sustain their families at home, and it seems to me that's a very positive development for U.S.-Latin American relations.
Hmm. Let's go to line one. This is Champagne for another caller. Hello.
Hello. First of all, I appreciate this conversation. I think it's lately with the media, it's been very slighted against immigrants, and it's good to hear some of the other side. One question I have is that you hear a lot of rhetoric about cost to schools and cost to hospitals, but you never hear about what the undocumented worker gives to by paying taxes and by paying Social Security. I'd like to ask the professor how much money is actually paid into federal and state taxes that is never collected, and how much is paid into Social Security that's never collected, and how would a change in illegal immigration change that?
That's a matter of real controversy. Clearly, if you're an illegal worker, you're just working for a dollar wage. You're not really on the payroll, and you're paid by the day or you're paid by the week, and therefore you're not really part of the formal process. But
I know a lot of illegal undocumented workers that do pay taxes and pay Social Security. So.
Well, depends on the job they have. That's right. If they're hired by certain firms, they're forced to be put into the system. What we really need is just a wholesale relook at. Now, individual states have certain policies. There are national policies in place. We need to relook at both state and local and national policies with regard to the rights of workers as well as to the rights of American workers in terms of displacement. It's a very complicated and very volatile issue, no matter how you cut at it. And it ranges, of course, from where the Mexican community is concentrated, or the Cuban-American community, or the Haitian community. There are also great differences in terms of the legal and the illegal communities in the United States, who are also very mobile. Chicago, New York City, Miami, Los Angeles, many other cities now have very large Latin American communities, and there are differences from community to community.
Okay, thank you.
All right, let's go to Urbana for another call. This is line three. Hello.
Hello. Yes, Congress should be concerned about Latin America because Chavez wants to build a nuclear reactor, which, of course, will give him the materials to make a dirty bomb or possibly even a nuclear weapon. But my question is, to what extent does the spraying of the cocoa plants fuel the anti-American resentment in the Latin American region? I cite three reasons for that. One, when the native people do use cocoa for their own consumption as well as export, and as I understand it, the spray sometimes gets their edible crops as well as contaminates the water. So to what extent do you think that fuels anti-Americanism, the spraying of the cocoa plants?
Well, it's not just the eradication program, which is the backbone of the American policy in the Andean countries in South America. It's really that the United States has never really followed through with a commitment of crop substitution. In other words, if you're going to convince the Indian populations, of which coca is very much part of their traditional culture, it is not just making drugs, but it's using the coca leaf to reduce hunger for medicinal as well as cultural purposes, there has to be a commitment to providing a new crop for them. Second, unless the U.S. is willing to legalize these drugs, if you eradicate in one country, the crop development moves to another country, and it's the old balloon effect. You stop it in one place, it pops up in the other. And third, there's, I think, a growing sense among many people in South America that the issue is less production than it is consumption in the United States and in Europe. And that as long as politicians in Europe and the U.S. are unwilling to face up to the large consumption at very high prices, there is always going to be supply. And the United States is viewed increasingly as not understanding the consumption side, but of penalizing the Latin American countries for the production side.
But what might be the substitute crops? Like I read that coffee takes twice the area and half the profit.
Yeah, I think we need to be very, very proactive in looking for not just other crops, but finding low-level assembly plant processes for these people, you know, for taking a look at the other development options they have. For example, Bolivia, which is a very important part of this drug war from the U.S. point of view, is sitting on an extraordinary amount of natural gas. But there's a great controversy in Bolivia about developing the natural gas because the union leaders and the peasant folks believe that the wealth that would be developed from that gas product would go to the elites, to the wealthy people in the country. The U.S. has to be more proactive in trying to come up with ways in which these natural resources can be developed, and the income from those resources would be going into social development funds for the people in the country and not into Miami or European bank accounts.
All right, thank you.
Thanks. I'll just have you respond to one of the points that the caller made, the first point he made. It seems that a lot of the coverage of Latin America is has to do with the verbal sparring between the Bush administration and Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela. Do you think that Venezuela constitutes a security risk to the United States?
No, I don't. Not at this time. Where we'll be in a year or two, we don't know. What is, and I spend a lot of time in Latin America, what is clear is that Colonel Chavez, President Chavez, is an increasingly appealing figure in South America for many South Americans. He is being very supportive, for example, of the financial problems in countries like Argentina and Ecuador. He has offered to provide subsidized oil products for 25 years to the government of Uruguay. He is flying people from the Caribbean who have cataracts at his expense to Cuba to be operated on at his expense. He's doing a number of things that are really addressing real development, social development, and human development problems in many of these countries. Now, he's doing it, obviously, out of his own ambition and his own belief in what he calls a Bolivarian revolution, that is, after Simón Bolívar, one of the founders after independence of the Latin American countries. But it's a very appealing set of policies, and the United States has not been able to come up with a set of counter policies or policies that would indeed go beyond what Colonel Chavez is doing.
Hmm. Well, does his agenda run counter to the interest of the United States?
Certainly to the degree to which he supports populist, we might say left of center in another historical context, with populist governments, sure, those people are not particularly in favor of U.S. foreign investment in their countries. They're not in favor of the so-called market model, which the U.S. supports, open capitalism. Chavez calls it savage capitalism in the Americas. The U.S., from their point of view, we don't really appear to be very concerned about social development issues. He's providing a great deal of money thus far in Venezuela for schools, for clinics, for hospitals. Very often these are manned by Cubans sent by Fidel Castro. So to the degree to which the United States or a particular administration sees the reemergence of Fidel Castro in South America as a menace to U.S. security interests, that's of real concern. Thus far, Chavez appears to be rather big on speeches and on trying to find any way he can to insult the United States, and he's quite successful at doing that.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Ryerdon Rott from the Paul Nitzer School of Advanced International Studies at the Johns Hopkins University in Washington, D.C., where he is director of Western Hemisphere Studies and also director of the Latin American Studies Program, also founding director of the Center of Brazilian Studies and founding director of the Program on U.S.-Mexico Relations, author of a number of books and articles. He's been following politics in Latin America for quite a long time. Questions are welcome here as we continue to talk about relations between the United States and Latin America. 333-9455 is our Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. On to another caller. This is Urbana and line one. Hello.
Yeah, you said, your guest said that Venezuela wasn't much of a security threat, but I think your guest underestimates Washington's seemingly infinite capacity for insecurity, first point. But my question would be, you mentioned natural resources and how Latin Americans would like to develop them in such a way that at least the lion's share of the profit that ensues actually goes to helping the bulk of the people there instead of just a narrow scum on the top. In terms of that, I'm sure that these alignments that you occasionally get a glimpse of between Latin American countries and Asia or Latin American countries and Europe and even the Middle East, occasionally get a glimmer of that. And I was wondering, how would you characterize what's going on that front and the countermeasures being attempted by the U.S. It's very difficult to piece it together reading newspapers here, and I'm sure you're one of the few people who could possibly speak intelligently about that. Could you address that, and I'll hang up. Thanks.
I guess it was the outreach from Latin America to other parts of the world.
Yeah, I guess particularly Asia.
Yeah. The South Americans have continuing negotiations with the European Union, but that's now been frozen, if you will, by the agricultural subsidies issue. The new and interesting issue in South America was the visit in November of last year of President Hu Jintao of China with a very large business investment delegation looking for strategic partnerships. And I think there's some concern in some circles in Washington, D.C., with the sudden emergence of China as a major player in buying South American commodities, natural resources, iron ore, soybeans, and are there other implications to that down the road? We know that the Chinese government in Beijing is very anxious to have all of the countries in the world withdraw recognition from the island of Taiwan and to recognize Beijing. That, I think, is one of the diplomatic goals of the Chinese government in Latin America. Second is no question that the natural resource and commodity trade in which China is very deeply involved now is very positive in the short to medium term for the Latin American countries. And since China doesn't have soybeans or iron ore, those two commodities plus others will become increasingly, are important, and will become increasingly important for South America. So I see a new era of Latin American, or at least South American, Asian ties emerging now and over the next couple of years.
Hmm. Again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'd like to have you talk a little bit about Brazil for a couple of reasons, because there will be presidential elections there next year, and there are apparently questions, people asking questions about just how well President Lula da Silva has done as president, and also because over the long term, people identify Brazil as being a place with a potential of being one of the most powerful countries in the world, at least economically speaking, if we look down the road maybe 20, 30, 40 years. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about Brazilian politics just right at the moment, but then also that kind of take that kind of long-term view about Brazil's future in the world economy.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk in think tanks around the United States about the new emerging powers, both in terms of trade but also in terms of politics, South Africa, India, China, Brazil, and a couple of others. And I think we are seeing the beginnings of a transformation in the international system, both politically as well as economically, but it will take a long time. It'll be an evolutionary process. And there's a big debate about expanding the Security Council to include some of these countries at the United Nations is a good example, I think, of that. That's now been frozen for a number of reasons, but it will come back again. You know, in the trade talks that are taking place at the World Trade Organization, you know, Brazil, India are playing a very important leadership role in trying to structure the agenda to come up with a final trade agreement. That was not true 10 or 15 years ago. It's now a reality that the U.S. and the European countries are going to have to accept. Brazil is clearly the pivot in South America. It's half the continent of South America. It has about 175 million people. It also has tremendous levels of injustice, inequality, and poverty that need to be addressed. And President Lula, I think, is seen by some significant part of the population as a man committed to doing that. He is the first poor person, if you will, who has been elected president of Brazil in the history of that very interesting country. His government is now, unfortunately, plagued by a corruption scandal. Corruption is not new in Brazil by any means, but his Workers' Party was thought by many people at the last election 3 years ago to be above that. We've now discovered that, unfortunately, the leadership of the party was very much involved in campaign financing corruption and other kinds of financial misdealings. None of that has touched President Lula thus far. He has not announced whether he'll run for president in the October 2006 elections. My sense is that he will. Whether or not he can win a second term, we don't know, given democratic politics in any country. But he will have gained a place in history, having run three times and winning on the fourth try for the presidency, for emphasizing things like hunger and poverty, trying to put together programs that address those issues in Brazil by increasing Brazil's visibility on the world stage. He travels a great deal and is a very eloquent spokesman for a greater role for the Brazils and the Indias in world commerce as well as in world politics. So, interesting man with a very difficult job and a very complex and very complicated country.
Well, let me just take that one step further, and then I have a caller we'll get to. When he took office at the beginning of 2003, as you say, he laid out this very ambitious kind of agenda to try to improve the life of Brazilians, particularly people who were on the bottom. How successful has he been?
Not as successful as he would have liked or we would have liked. In part, he had a very complicated agenda on the other end of dealing with pension reform, social security for the better-off people in Brazil, and he made some moderate success in reducing those benefits and controlling the growing costs for social security. There were some other important structural changes passed by the Congress during the first 2 years. Nothing has been passed this year. Getting these large programs off the ground in any country is very complicated, very bureaucratic. Brazil is a very, as we are, feisty federal system where governors at the state level and mayors are important political players. They're trying to coordinate 20-some-odd states in very different stages of social and economic development in Brazil. They have a very poor northeast, as we have a somewhat poor south. Means that you have to make compromises all the time. And Lula probably has done as well as we would expect anyone to do so. Better if these corruption scandals had not happened this year, which has slowed down the agenda in Congress. And as in any country, ours included, next year is an election year, and we won't expect very much to get through. So it's a very slow, evolutionary, very painful process to introduce social change into these countries in the region.
Let's talk with another caller here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. One of my interests is family planning, and I realize that it's only a portion of the effort to get people out of poverty. But it often seems to me that the U.S. government's efforts by the conservative aspects to keep the U.S. from contributing to family planning funds in the U.N. when they claim that it's a pro-life thing because there are groups that pay for abortions or that provide abortions. But it seems to me that if you don't contribute to family planning services, that you help keep the supply of poor, desperate people who are willing to work for next to nothing and in crummy conditions, that you keep that supply up, both in countries that we trade with and in terms of people who are coming to the U.S. as illegals. And I was wondering what your thoughts were on that, and if there were any Latin American countries and South American countries that were making any progress on the family planning front.
Very controversial issue in the region, as you probably know, in that the Roman Catholic Church is a very strong institution and, of course, opposed to family planning. Now, having said that the church is very powerful, it doesn't mean a lot of people go to church on Sunday morning. What it does mean is that the Catholic Church is a very powerful lobby on certain kinds of social questions. That being said, some countries have moved ahead and have legalized abortion, for example. Family planning is moving much more slowly. A related issue, of course, is how you deal with AIDS. You know, Brazil has been a superb leader in introducing or providing support for generic AIDS drugs, which, of course, were opposed by the major European and American drug companies. So in different countries, in different ways, issues like family planning are moving along the agenda, and I think we'll see more attention to that in the 21st century. The possible next president of Chile to be elected in December is a woman, a former health minister, a former defense minister, very open on many of these kinds of questions. Chile is a very progressive society in some ways, very conservative in others, so we'll have to wait and see what her agenda will be. But I think it's the inbuilt conservatism in many of the Latin American countries where family values are very important. We find that with the immigrants coming to our country who tend to vote Republican on family value for family value reasons. And I think that's also the case in much of the rural, more conservative parts of South America. But I see this as becoming as you say, an important issue in terms of social development throughout the region. What the region does not need is burgeoning populations, and demographic questions, I think, are on the minds of a lot of the region's political leaders.
There's a population group that's, their motto is, whatever your cause is, it's a lost cause unless we can keep population in under control. And
we see that worldwide, don't we? It's look at China, where they've tried for decades to limit the number of children born, but they're now releasing people from that situation. And I think that there's no question that we need more sensible thinking about the whole family planning issue, the resources available, and the institutional infrastructure to take care of people as we age.
Well, and the AIDS epidemic and not dealing with the realities of it is not exactly pro-family to avoid that issue and to pretend that it's better to not use birth control, not use condoms. It's just...
That's where Brazil has done a superb job of fighting back the drug companies, fighting back against the church, and major... I've had students during the summer as interns working on some of these programs with AIDS victims, but also to preclude the growth of the AIDS population through explaining the use of condoms and facilitating this kind of thing. So Brazil has taken a very strong stance on this. Other countries have been much slower and more conservative.
I want to thank the caller for her comments. We're getting kind of short on time here, so I want to jump in. And I do just want to ask a very quick question. It may be kind of a side question, but it goes to the point that you made about the fact that, as we know, traditionally, historically, the Roman Catholic Church has been a very powerful institution in Latin America. Also, though, in recent years, Protestant evangelicals based in the United States have become increasingly active in Latin America as well. Has that grown to the point where it is any kind of a challenge to the Catholic Church?
Less to the Catholic Church, although certainly the leadership of the Church is concerned by the number of people who tend to go to services if they are evangelicals compared to those who are Roman Catholics. But it's also become, in some countries, a very important political force, a very conservative political force. In Brazil, for example, some politicians are elected, indeed, on the basis of support from the various evangelical churches. It's becoming strong in Central America. So, I think in the long term, the leadership of the Roman Catholic Church is concerned about this. And the fact that the evangelicals preach a set of policies that go beyond just religion, but in terms of, again, family values, in terms of employment, in terms of participation in your local community, all of these are seen by an increasing number of people as very positive.
Let's talk with someone in Homewood, which is up in the Chicago area, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. Try and ask this so we can get a short answer. But as I remember, the arguments for NAFTA, one of them was that it would raise the standard of living in Mexico and decrease the number of illegal immigrants. That doesn't seem to have happened, has it? Or why didn't it?
Well, NAFTA is a very complicated issue. It certainly has benefited the business communities. It certainly has not had the social benefits that we expected. If you go back to the year 94, the United States, for example, promised that we would retrain and relocate American workers who were displaced by NAFTA. Washington never got around to finding the money to do that. And similar problems, I think, have emerged on both sides of the border. While NAFTA is a three-country agreement, the Canadian-U.S. relationship is very different than the U.S.-Mexican relationship. And one or two of the presidential candidates in next year's election in Mexico indeed have raised the issue of revisiting, not closing down NAFTA, but of revisiting NAFTA and taking a look at exactly the social implications that should have been given more attention during the previous 10 years.
Okay, thanks. It's our politicians again, promise and don't deliver.
All right, well, thanks for the call. Let's take someone here in Aurora. This is our line number 2. Hello.
Yeah, I was going to speak to the issue of, maybe I should say that I had a roofer come to work for me. He came and we started to talk. Very nice. I've had a lot of Hispanics work for me, Mexicans, whatever, and they've always been wonderful. And we talked about family, and then we got on to children. So I said to him, well, how many children do you have? And he said, 4, but I'm going to have more. And I said to him, why? Do you realize how hard that is on a woman's body to have children and so many children? And I tried to explain, and all I could think of is if I could speak the language, Spanish, I would do a better job of trying to tell him how that tears a woman's body apart when you have 5 or 6 or 7 children. That's all I have to say.
Well,
informative program.
Well, thank you for the call. I don't know if you want to say or can say something about social attitudes towards family, which has always been something that's been very obviously very important in Latin America, and whether that is changing at all.
It depends. In urban areas, certainly it is. In the rural areas, and Latin America has still very large, large rural population. Those conservative beliefs, we call them family values here, but in terms of going to church, having a large family, the 19th century justification for a large family was much like in the U.S. that many children died young or at childbirth, and therefore you needed more people to work in the fields and that kind of thing. That argument still holds to some degree in the more underdeveloped parts of Latin America, but a great deal of it, I think, is tradition. A great deal of it is the idea that the man is entitled to a large family, the whole macho idea, a fear or a misunderstanding of the importance of using condoms at a certain point in family development. All of these ideas are relatively new in many parts of the region.
Because of the kind of coverage, particularly, I think, that has been given to the tension, or at least the war of words between the government of Venezuela and the Bush administration, one sometimes gets the impression that the United States doesn't have many friends in Latin America. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily true. If you ask the question, well, what governments in Latin America are, the strongest supporters of the United States, or where both sides would say their relationship is very positive, are there any?
Well, certainly in Central America. I think that was part of the great debate over the CAFTA, or the Central American Free Trade Area, El Salvador, Honduras, those countries. The Dominican Republic are certainly viewed, I think, by the United States as being particularly favorable to U.S. positions. Many of the Caribbean countries, I think, as well. I think as you move down the Andes and towards South America, there is a sense among many of us that there is a, not a hostility necessarily, but a growing disinterest on the part of those governments, in particular in the United States, and a search for options, whether it be with the European Union, whether it be with Hugo Chavez, whether it be in sub-regional or regional organizations like Mercosur, the common market they're trying to put together in South America, or the series of other organizations that have been put together over the last 10 years. So it's, I think it's a logical evolutionary process in which, unlike the 50s and 60s, where Uncle Sam was so powerful and all-present, there's no more Cold War, and many of the governments are looking for alternative political policies.
Mm. And just in the short run here, do you think that things particularly are going to change much? I guess particularly I'm thinking about the kind of things we were talking about at the beginning, with this sense that a lot of people have that the United States is not engaged in Latin America to the extent that perhaps it should be.
No, unfortunately, I don't think it's going to change. And this is a bipartisan problem, that neither the Democrats nor the Republicans have any particular answers for Latin America's problems. And we're so engaged in Iraq, and we're so engaged in other parts of the world, that there really isn't very much time for a healthy discussion about policies that impact the U.S. and policies that would be good for both Latin America and the United States.
Well, there we're going to have to leave it. We're here at the end of the time. Our guest, Riordan Rott, he is at the Paul Nitzer School of Advanced International Studies at the Johns Hopkins University in Washington, D.C., where he is Director of Western Hemisphere Studies and also Director of the Latin American Studies Program. And Professor Rott, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.